Hi everybody, welcome to Dhamma Threads. I'm Bhante Sujata, and we're going to be discussing with our friends here the Sammadhiti Sutta, the discourse on right view. And we've been discussing this for a number of sessions now, and we've reached the section of the sutta that's talking about aging and death. And one of the characteristics of the Buddha's teachings was that he never flinched in talking about things as they really are. And so we don't have to be afraid of suffering. We don't have to be afraid of separation. We don't have to be afraid of death. We come from a Buddhist point of view. In fact, when we see these things, it's always a reminder of the Dhamma. And so it's not something to be depressed about or to be worried about. We should be depressed if we see those things and if there's nothing we can do. Right? This is what causes despair. People see death, they see disease, they see suffering, and they can't imagine what can be done to overcome these things. And in a sense, it's true. We will never overcome aging. We'll never overcome death, and nor really should we. Right? But so we can't overcome them in a physical sense, but spiritually, we can learn to understand them and to accept them. And by understanding and accepting them, the Buddha's promise was that we can learn to transcend these things. So let's begin by, as usual, by reading out the section of the sutta that deals with aging and death. Okay. So Venerable Sariputta has been giving this discourse, and he's giving it the discourse in a series of question and answers with the group of bhikkhus. And so it continues, saying, "Good friend," the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. "But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma?" "There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands aging and death, the origin of aging and death, the cessation of aging and death, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is aging and death? What is the origin of aging and death? What is the cessation of aging and death? And what is the way leading to the cessation of aging and death? The aging of beings in the various orders of beings, their old age, brokenness of teeth, grayness of hair, wrinkling of skin, decline of life, weakness of faculties. This is called aging. The passing of beings out of the various orders of beings. They're passing away. Dissolution, disappearance, dying, completion of time, dissolution of the aggregates, laying down of the body. This is called death. So this aging and this death are what is called aging and death. With the arising of birth, there's the arising of aging and death. With the cessation of birth, there is the cessation of aging and death. The way leading to the cessation of aging and death is just this noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When the noble disciple has thus understood aging and death, the origin of aging and death, the cessation of aging and death, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death, then, flipping back to the place where it's, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust, he abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion, he extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, his view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so this is a section on aging and death. So I'll just make a couple of preliminary remarks. Our first thing is that we've already encountered aging and death earlier in the sutta. Okay, so here the Buddha is repeating himself. We'll come back to that question in just a moment. Secondly, just some basic points here. The translation, the Pali word that we're dealing here is jara, okay, jara maranam. An interesting detail is that, of course, Pali and English and the modern European languages share a common ancestry. They're all from the Indo-European family of languages. Now, one of the details about this which is interesting is that the words which are held in common, okay, between those groups of languages, we're talking a long way in the past now, like 3000 BC, something like that, the words which are held in common are usually words which are important for that culture at that time. Okay? So, for example, the word go in Pali is cow in English. Okay? So that was very important in that culture, right? Whereas the word elephant is not common because they didn't have elephants at that time. The word for horse is ashva in Sanskrit or asa in Pali. And, of course, that was very important for the Aryan peoples at that time. So that was like a common thing. Whereas, say, the word fish is matcha in Pali, right? Because the Aryan people came from the central Asian region, and because they, obviously it wasn't a lot of fish around in the desert. So fish wasn't so important. So this is one way that we can see what was important for people all that time before. One of the things that I noticed is that when we're coming into these terms, and this is beginning the sequence of terms in the dependent origination, and all of these words have a common Indo-European root. And that's actually quite unusual to find so many words with an Indo-European root. So in this case, the word for aging is jara, okay, in Pali. And in English, of course, is cognate with the words geriatric, yeah, and all of those words, yeah, so meaning the same thing, yeah. And the word for marana is cognate with English mortality and mortal and all of those kind of series of words. So this is why in English, for example, when Tolkien was writing, you know, he would say Mordor, right? Yeah, because it actually harks back to all these words meaning death and so on and so forth. Huh? And to me, what this suggests is that these concepts, the things that the Buddha was drawing on, were there, were present in the culture, and at that time in that place, I'm talking now in the Indo-European culture, 2,000 years before the Buddha, there began to be an awareness and a consciousness of these things in some kind of important way. They began to be existentially important for the people. They began to reflect on them. What are these things? Why do people get old? What is this thing called death? Yeah, and these questions were starting to come up in the culture at that time. Alain de Botton, the English philosopher, said that religions are cultures of repetition, and you know, and I think that's common not just in Buddhism but in other religions as well. You know, if you're in, and this is certainly my experience when I was brought up as a Catholic, you sort of go along to the church every Sunday and you hear more or less the same sermon with a few variations, right? And the point being that the actual truths that we're trying to get across are actually pretty simple most of the time, right? And, you know, obviously there's something to be learnt in terms of the contents and so on, but the most important thing is to just keep being reminded of those simple truths. And he pointed out, and I think it's a very good point, that in the academic world, in our modern education, we have the very strange idea that you can somehow be in a classroom when you're 14 and somebody will tell you something and you're expected to remember that for the rest of your life. And it's complete madness, right? You've forgotten it by 5 minutes later. You've certainly forgotten it by the time you've walked out of the classroom. So with the religious teachings, especially the Dhamma teachings, it's structured so that it's a constant reminder going over the same things from a slightly different perspective and teaching you the same thing again and again and again. And the other very important thing about the repetition is something that's become really apparent to me. I've been working on this website, Sutta Central, and we've been editing and putting together the Buddhist texts from all different traditions of Pali, Chinese, Sanskrit, and so on, and lots of repetitions there, right? And you realize that it's all about backups, okay? If you've got, you know, we know, Sinsin was just talking about earlier, he did this essay when he was younger and then the file got corrupted and he's like, all these days of work and then the despair and, well, 6,000 words gone, right? And we've all been there, right? We just said that because I was doing an email this morning and it just vanished when I finished the email. So, the suttas are structured so that if you lose some suttas, it doesn't matter too much, right? And so the Sangha in those early days was deeply concerned to preserve the Dhamma and pass the Dhamma down. And we find this echoed again and again and again in the narratives and stories around that period, yeah? So that the true Dhamma can last long. And so they gathered all of these suttas. They didn't care how many times you repeat the same thing in a slightly different way. That's fine, right? You have 10 different versions of the same thing. Then somebody forgets one of them, that's kind of all right. You've still got 9 of them left, yeah? And so they keep on repeating them and repeating them. This is why, like in each Nikaya, you find almost always that the main teaching, so for example, this teaching on aging and death and so on, we find in the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, we find it here in the Majjhima Nikaya, we also find it in the Nidana Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. I don't know if we find it exact those paragraphs in the Anguttara Nikaya. Can't remember off the top of my head, but certainly in most of the Nikayas we find that same thing. Also in the Abhidhamma we find the same thing. So all those different collections, right? And these, remember, would have all been maintained usually or often in different monasteries, right? So the different teams of reciters with different teachers would have been reciting these in different places, and then every so often they'd get together and recite together to keep them all consistent and so on. And so all of that is backups, right? Somebody makes a mistake, somebody forgets something, then it can always be corrected because somebody has the same passage from somewhere else. The Digha reciter gets together with the Majjhima reciter and says, no. Aging is, breaking of teeth comes before the wrinkling of skin, not the other way around, yeah? And, which I can prove from my own experience. I broke my teeth when I was a kid, so that definitely happens first. So, when we're reading the literature, like any form of literature, it is dependent on and shaped by the form and the cultural surroundings that make it possible. Yeah, and just as we can do different kinds of literature now with computers that we couldn't do before with pen and paper or with printing. Yeah, in the same way, the oral literature, there are certain things which become possible and certain things which are closed off, certain things you can't do. And so this is one of the ways that I think, you know, incredibly skillfully and incredibly powerfully that they use the limitations of that oral culture in order to preserve the teachings. Yeah. So let's see what the Buddha says about birth. Oh, sorry, Venerable Sariputta. What's Venerable Sariputta says about birth? Saying, good friend, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words, and they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma? And Sariputta replied, there might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands birth, the origin of birth, the cessation of birth, and the way leading to the cessation of birth, in that way, he is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is birth? What is the origin of birth? What is the cessation of birth? What is the way leading to the cessation of birth? The birth of beings in the various orders of beings, their coming to birth, precipitation in a womb, generation, manifestation of the aggregates, obtaining the basis for contact, this is called birth. With the arising of being, there is the arising of birth. With the cessation of being, there is the cessation of birth. The way leading to the cessation of birth is just this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood birth, the origin of birth, the cessation of birth, and the way leading to the cessation of birth, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So this is the section on birth, and I'll just make a few comments on that section before we go into the discussion. As with the discussion on old age and death, here we have a description which is straightforwardly in a sort of organic sense, right, of what organic birth is. The birth of beings in the various orders of beings, and in other suttas, such as the Mahanidana Sutta and so on, it sort of clarifies what it means is the birth of birds into the order of birds, of crawling things and crawling things, humans as humans, quadrupeds as quadrupeds, devas as devas, and so on. So the precipitation in the womb, that's one of the problems in translating these things sometimes is that the Pali words have a fairly clear contextual meaning. Sometimes when people translate it, they try to translate it to a way that kind of captures the literal meaning of it, as well as the contextual meaning. Okay, so in this case, we have a word like abhinibhati, which just means rebirth. Okay, and it really should be just translated in the same way. Here Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as precipitation, which is, it's not really a word that we use in English to talk about being reborn, is it, right? Oh, yes, I had a new baby was precipitated the other day. It's not exactly what we kind of say, right? So it should be something. But actually, jati more commonly means conception, actually, rather than birth, even though we use birth. But literally, the way that it's used means conception. Yeah. And so all of these words, even though it's not entirely clear in the English translations, the manifestation of the aggregates and obtaining the basis for contact. So this occurs, as is made clear in suttas like Mahanidana Sutta and the Mahatamha Sankhaya Sutta. And this refers to the, it doesn't refer to just the sort of opening your eyes and seeing or something like that, but it refers to the organic development of the sense organs in the embryo. Okay, so this is what when an embryo is first developing, you know, first it develops the sense of touch, yeah, and then gradually the different sense organs develop and the capacity to experience these different ways develops. So this is what it means here by obtaining the basis for contact. Again, it's one of those phrases which is quite clear in the Pali, but it's a little bit awkward to try to translate it directly into English. Even though, I mean, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations are the, you know, by far the most precise and the most accurate, but I still think that in some ways he has a tendency to perhaps be a little bit overly literal in the renderings, and perhaps sometimes, you know, would like to see things that were rendered a bit more sort of just straightforwardly translating the meaning. It can be a little bit less misleading sometimes. Although I understand it's a matter of, you know, judgment and balance about how that's applied in different contexts, so it's not one's right or one's wrong. But especially when understanding the technical terms and the way that they're used, it's very important to be reserved and cautious about what kinds of inferences we make on the use of certain words. This is something I find that people often make the mistake when they're reading the suttas, is that they'll read a particular English word and they'll immediately spin off on some connotation that English word has for them. Right? Of course, that connotation that they're bouncing off is completely alien to the meaning of the actual underlying Pali word. Right? It just happens to have been picked up for some reason because of the choice of translation. So especially with these more subtle, more philosophical terms, we need to sort of just be cautious about what we're reading into it and to try to be sensitive to how the words are used in different contexts. And this is one of the advantages of, having mentioned the disadvantage of the translation style that Venerable Bodhi uses, which is very literal, the advantage of that style is that he as much as possible uses the same English word to translate the same Pali word in different contexts, right? So even though that sometimes means that in one particular context or another it might be a bit awkward, what it does mean is that you can actually see that this word is being used across these different contexts, yeah? And you can actually recognize this is the same word that's being used. And if your translation is less precise, you can't get that, yeah? So these are just the balances that the translators have to strive for. So it's a matter of appreciating the particular approach that a translator's used and trying to understand the effect that it has on how you read the text. Yeah. Forget everything we've learned about Dhamma. Try to put ourselves in the mind state of people who are living in the time of the Buddha. Yeah? Now, that was an agrarian culture. Right? People would plant the seeds, grow the rice, and so on. And so this idea of the cycles of the seasons, the cycles of birth and death and so on is completely embedded in your consciousness, right? And you're doing that every year. That's what your life consists of, planting the seed, watching it grow, nurturing it, harvesting it, planting it again, and so on. And you see these cycles going again and again and again and again, yeah? And so this idea of the cycle of life, right, the cycle of birth, aging, and death, is it emerges from this kind of culture. And the Buddha himself uses these imagery of like the seed and the field and so on when talking about rebirth. Yeah? And this is where it comes from. So in that cycle, right, how do we kind of relate to that cycle? Right? How do we relate to that cycle? What do we actually think about it? Well, the way that all religions relate to that, okay, the value that they place in that cycle is that they want more birth. Birth is what we're looking for, right? Yeah? And we see all religions, they have these fertility rituals, right? They have these seasonal rituals. In fact, I think this weekend is the Songkran festival in Thailand, right? This is another fertility ritual, right? You go around and you throw water on everybody, and this is to promote the rainy season and the water for the crops, and so that the good crops will grow. This is what all the religious and spiritual activities are about, is having more birth, more life, more of all of these things, yeah? And then once you do that, you then have to say, well, hang on, the problem is we've got all this birth, but then we have aging and death, right? So if life is intrinsically good and birth is what we're trying to get, how do we then deal with this problem of aging and death? And of course we can't, right? It can't ever be solved. And this is a massive problem that all these different religious and philosophical systems will wrestle with. There's a wonderful Hindu myth which I love, which is about when Brahma first created the world. He was a good god, and he only wanted happiness and life in the world, so he only put good things in the world, yeah? Of course, had a severe population problem, right? More and more and more people. Never, and no one would ever die, right? He invented birth, but he didn't invent death, yeah? And more people, and it became like hell. Yeah, and he tried to make everybody happy and everybody good, but he couldn't because there was no death. So he had to invent a goddess of death. Yeah, so he created a goddess of death, this new being, and she came to him and she said, "Rama, you are my creator. You've created me. What is my duty? Tell me what my dharma is, so that I can go and perform it in the world." And he told her, "Your dharma is to bring death." And she was so horrified. I can't do this. This is wrong. Killing is wrong. He said, "You have to do it." And she said, "Who do I have to kill?" He said, "Everybody, yeah? Old people, young people, good people, bad people, you will have to kill them all, yeah?" And she's just so horrified, she just refused, yeah? And went off, and it goes along. Sorry, these Hindu myths, they always go on with all these adventures and stories and things. But eventually, of course, she had to come back and accept it. Because we can't have life without death, yeah? This cycle is always there. So this is, when we see it that way, we realize how radical and how profound and how challenging the Buddha's teaching is, yeah? The only way we can deal with aging and death is to stop birth. There's this saying, I mentioned it in the Dhamma talk last night, but this saying by Rousseau, the French philosopher, said that man is born free, but is everywhere in chains. Yeah? That's a very nice kind of phrase. It sounds better in French, I'm sure. But, you know, he was talking as a social philosopher, right, from the European Enlightenment period. So he was talking about how we're imprisoned by society, by the culture and all of these kinds of things, and we're born free, right? It sounds very appealing, right? We have this kind of intrinsic nature which is free. From a Buddhist point of view, we're not born free at all. Yeah, we're born actually, look at a baby. What's a baby free to do? Really? Yeah? Crawl around? Well, no, actually, because if it crawls around too far, it'll hurt itself, yeah? And so you take the baby and you put it somewhere safe and you don't let it be free. And we can only use freedom when we have the maturity and the wisdom to know what are the limits of it. Otherwise, we need to have some control. And babies only gradually learn how to deal with freedom and choice and what's happening in the world, and that's what growing up is. And I think it's very interesting and I think an underappreciated aspect of the Buddha's teachings. I think he was the first religious or philosophical teacher anywhere to really address this question of infant development and bring this right into dependent origination. He talks about it quite explicitly in a number of suttas, in the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta, also in the Mahanidana Sutta and other places. You know, talks about how a child is born and gradually grows up, learns to play with toys and these kinds of things, gradually experiences things through the senses and likes and dislikes them and learns and grows through that whole kind of experience. So we come from this birth which in a sense has wiped off experiences and things that we've had from our past life, right? So we've done all this learning and growing from the past, yeah? And then we're rebooted. And we have to begin it all over again and go through that whole long, painful learning process. Yeah, this is part of the whole kind of suffering of birth, right? You have to go back to school, begin again, times, tables, adding, and all of that stuff. Yeah. So, but birth as an existential and a spiritual problem is not really an issue for us as such, right? I mean, aging and death is something that we're facing, but birth is something which is already behind us, right? If we're just considering this life, then we've been born, and maybe it was suffering or whatever, but that's all right, it's in the past, who cares, yeah? So birth as an existential problem in Buddhism always means rebirth, right? It always means what's going to happen to us next, yeah? So the point being that when we get old and we die, it doesn't stop there. We keep on going, yeah? Something else happens, right? We go to somewhere new. And we don't know what that process is. We don't know where we're going to be. Yeah, we don't know what it's going to be like when we get there. Yeah, all these are big unknowns. But we do know that wherever we arrive and whatever state that we're in, we're going to experience the same kinds of things that we've experienced in this life. Yeah, yeah? The same kinds of experiences. Yeah, getting hungry, getting tired, getting sick, falling in love, falling out of love, hating. All of those things. So that cycle keeps on going. So the Buddha is pointing here to how to raising that question. Right? At this point, he hasn't talked about the mechanisms underlying it. He hasn't described how we undo these things or anything like that. But he's raising the existential question, the existential situation. If we want to avoid, right, the suffering of aging and death, then the only way to bring that to an end is by ending rebirth. Okay, so in Western sort of science, you've had this kind of debate, I guess, over the years in anthropology and psychology and different fields that, as you say, nature versus nurture. So the idea of what is it that we're endowed with when we're born and what is that influences us as we grow up. And obviously there are, both of those things are important. And the question is, well, to what degree are they important and what areas do they influence us? And that, you know, that's been raised in a number of different regions. Yeah? So, for example, one controversy is, say, homosexuality. Right? Is that something which is genetically determined? Is it culturally determined? And, of course, different people have different views, and it's not easy to determine it. My personal feeling is that most of those kind of higher-level things, okay? So by higher-level things, I mean things that operate at a fairly sophisticated level of consciousness, right? So this is like a sort of sexual preference, or something like intelligence is another thing, right? So how much is intelligence inherited and how much is it due to culture, right? Not easy to determine at all, right? To my mind, most of those higher level things come about through a complicated interaction of things, and I don't think that those higher level things are usually one thing anyway. Right? I think there's just one word that we use and we assume that there's something that correlates to it. Whereas in fact it's a complex of quite different things that we're talking about, each of which is influenced by our nature and our nurture in different kinds of ways. As opposed to say something like eye color, for example, which is quite a simple thing and that's genetically determined and it's pretty straightforward, right? So these more sophisticated aspects of ourselves, you know, say something like intelligence. I don't think there is anything that's intelligence. I don't think an IQ test is measuring a thing called intelligence, right? I think an IQ test is measuring your ability to do IQ tests. Yeah, and if you think that it's important to be able to do IQ tests, then that's great. But there's no thing called intelligence which it's relating to. From a Buddhist point of view, though, what we would say is that in addition to the genetics, which is important, in addition to the culture, which is important, and the surroundings in your upbringing, there's also another factor, which is your karma, and which is not to be accounted for by these things. There was a study done some time ago, a very interesting study done of the behavior of identical twins in the womb. Huh? Very interesting. Yeah? Completely identical genetics, yeah? Identical environment, yeah? And yet distinct personalities. Yeah, just very distinct personalities. One, for example, one embryo will be more active, one more quieter, and that will maintain as they grow up into adulthood into different personalities. One's more extroverted, one's more introverted, and what's that X factor? What's the factor that can't be accounted for by genetics, can't be accounted for by culture and upbringing? From a Buddhist point of view, you'd say, well, that's the karma, right? And that's what they're bringing into it. So when a person is born, they're born into this world as a person, yeah? Born into this world as a distinct individual. And that's something I think that every parent knows, right? That they think of their children as being an extension of themselves. And gradually the evolution and the growth of a parent is to realize that actually this is a person who will make their own decisions. And sometimes I'm not going to like their decisions. And sometimes they're going to do all of these things that I don't understand because they're actually a distinct person. They're not just part of me, yeah? So, yeah, from a Buddhist point of view, we see these things as a complex interplay of different kinds of causality, yeah? So to come back to this question of birth, in a human realm, we are born in a way that everything's more or less wiped off, okay? Now, except in the case of people who can recollect their past lives, yeah? And I think that there's actually quite a lot of people, especially younger people, before the age of about 7, who can recollect their past lives to some degree or another. But leaving that aside, for the most part, our past is a mystery, yeah? So we get kind of reborn. So this is why that process, right, is hidden behind this veil of delusion, right? And this veil of ignorance, this avidya. As we go on in dependent origination, we're going to be coming closer to that avidya, yeah? Closer to understanding what is that veil that's hiding things, yeah? And this is what's hiding that precisely, that's what avidya means, is hiding what's happening, aging and death, and what happens after that when you get reborn. What actually is going on? Why does that process happen? What is the process? What's going on and why does it go on? Yeah. So from a Buddhist point of view, we can learn to understand that and we can learn to unravel it, yeah, by undoing the causes which are leading to birth. Yeah. And so those are things which we're going to be talking about more in the future sessions as we go and look at some of the other factors of dependent origination and how they're evolving. But I do believe that we're running out of time now. So our discussion of birth this morning will have to come to an end. It's got old and our discussion is about to die. So thank you so much for your attention and your participation. It's been a wonderful discussion as always. And I look forward to seeing you again next time.